Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme, we'll be welcoming back author Travis Elbre to discuss his new book, Atlas of the Unexpected, a trip around the globe visiting obscure locations, unlikely sites, and finding, Rob, surprising discoveries.
We'll also be hearing from Desiree Akhavan, the Iranian-American director whose acclaimed new film, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, explores sexuality and society's attitudes towards her.
And we'll be staying in the film world for a chat with Rossif Sutherland. The Canadian actor will be discussing new film Trench 11 and his place within an acting dynasty. Yes, it's those Sutherlands.
That is all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news. And we'll enjoy some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are, Tom.
What a week it's been, Rob.
On Monocle 24 side of the world, it's obviously always busy. Lots of exciting new things in the pipeline.
Well, and funny you should say that. Just keep listening in the week ahead. Lots of our programmes will be coming from Zurich this week. Very exciting. And what about, because you've been back for a couple of weeks, you were doing a couple of
zooming around.
Reports from all around.
Yeah,
can people read the fruits of those labours?
So The Escapist hits newsstands this week as well. Very nice, bright, poppy cover. There's been quite a bit of summer into autumn, but don't worry, there's kind of alpine address books and there's all sorts of things. The thing that I did was a road trip from New Orleans to New Mexico, super fun. That's one of our long 16-page stories. I was lucky to do that. That was wonderful stuff. But I've got a bit of a hankering for some kind of next week's news. I need to know. I need to look in a crystal ball. How about you, Tom?
Yeah, let's warm the news cockles with a man who knows how to do exactly that. There was something.
Who would have thought it? After that introduction, it's only Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Faye, welcome to the programme. And where are we going on our first trip?
Well, very important. It's happening today. The Swedes are voting for a new parliament and, of course, a new prime minister as well. But I think this election is particularly interesting because, you know, from according to the polls, you know, the far right, it seems they will do very well. Some polls are even predicting they will have 20%, could even be the largest party. I don't think they'll be the largest party, but, you know, it's clearly something dramatic happening in Swedish politics, because in Sweden, let's remember, it's one of the few, European countries in a way where the government, they don't talk to the far right, neither the centre-right, neither the centre-left. But is this working? For the first time, you know, if the Swedish Democrats, which is the far-right party, get 20%, the centre-left and the centre-right, they will have to do a major coalition, because they will have a stronger say in parliament as well. So yeah, it'll be very interesting to say. And the Swedes, they like to see themselves as very kind of moderate, you know, very progressive in a way. And they did welcome a lot of refugees, but there's been quite a few problems with integration, and it'll be a controversial one.
Sweden is always the kind of poster boy for centre-left, very liberal, high-taxing, progressive politics and government and all the rest of it. So this is kind of quite a bit of fly in the ointment for that kind of idea, I suppose, across the world, but especially across Europe, I suppose. Yeah, it'll be an interesting one to see the results come in tonight.
I think we might have to change our perspective, because I think in Europe at the moment, I think very few countries, you know, are being truly progressive. I think Portugal perhaps is one of the few good examples as well with this happening. Let's keep an eye on the post tonight, what's going to be the result. I'm sure we'll be covering as well tomorrow in our news shows as well. The second story is a little bit more fun in a way. It's about perfume. And I think, to be honest, Tom, I'm looking at you because I want you to commission me to go there next year.
Okay.
It's a Petit Fragrance. It's the 2018 edition, and it starts on the 14th, on Friday. And basically, it's you know, we've been to Petit Uomo, you know, all these kind of new brands, menswear, but this one is all about perfume and scents. And of course, it's more the kind of the artistic type. So it's not going to be a mass event, you know. So you're not going to see, you know, the latest Calvin Klein or Armani perfume.
Is it sort of more of a, almost kind of a B2B? Is there sort of a trade fair, really, fair? Is there a lot of kind of, you know, the inside developments, the big things that can push the sort of whole industry forward? Is that, I wonder what sort of innovations get discussed at this sort of forum?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I did say, you know, it's not going to, the mass brands, they're not going to be there, but there'll be more than 100 exhibitors, you know, so it's quite big, you know, fair. And I didn't know much about the Fragrance one, but, you know, it's another one of those amazing trade fairs that PT seems to do.
It's really interesting.
And I'll certainly want to go there.
Well, I was going to say, so good, you're touting for 2019, is that right?
I'm already applying.
Do you know where, and where's that taking place?
Well, it's going to be in Italy, in Florence as well. So
a little Florentine trip.
Why not?
We can talk about that, yeah. Fernando, I think.
Fernando, what's number three?
Well, number three, if you like cinema, you know, Toronto Film Festival is on at the moment until the 16th of September. And I have to say, I mean, they keep saying this every year, but it's true. I mean, the lineup this year is incredible. And I think people say, oh, Venice is kind of... If you look at the best films at Venice Film Festival, you know what's happening at the Oscars. But I think you can kind of say this about Toronto as well. We have the latest Steve McQueen film, The Widows, which I'm dying to see as well. Some controversies, again, Alfonso Cuarón has a new film called Roma, which will be released on Netflix. But then some, you know, the cinema distributors in the US are already saying, well, will it be in the cinemas as well, or will it go straight to Netflix? You know, the usual controversies that we've been talking. Michael Moore's new film as well about the Trump era, Fahrenheit 11/9. So it'll be quite an interesting one. Of course, Lady Gaga in Star is Born, the latest from Damien Chazelle, where you have Neil Armstrong being played by Ryan Gosling as well.
What do I detect from that? Slightly cheeky smile there. Neil Armstrong played by everyone.
It was playful.
He was a bit playful, but yeah. I think
people can hear you smiling.
I could have controlled myself.
I think that's nice. I like it.
It was an accidental.
Power to the Gosling elbow.
Exactly.
Fernando, thank you very much indeed.
And there'll be more from Fernando a little later in the programme, and more Canadian cinema as well, Rob. But what have we got coming up next?
Next, Tom, we're going to head into uncharted territory. The writer Travis Elborough has been here in the past to talk about topics ranging from the simple joys of the park to the history of the 20th century and reflections on the act of writing itself. His constantly curious outlook means it should come as no great surprise that he's got a new book out now called Atlas of the Unexpected.
It looks at some of the less conventional discoveries that have unearthed some of our now most familiar cultural touchstones. The Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, were discovered by a stray goat, according to Travis, and the island of Madeira owes some of its history to a romance between shipwrecked lovers. He joins us now to talk through it. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, Travis.
Pleasure.
Good to have
you
with us. Now, I guess that setup, you know, reflects that talk about haphazard, chance places, a degree of serendipity. Do you need a serendipitous touch as well when putting a book like this together?
Maybe less accidental. I think the accident, I think, implies a certain carelessness of construction. But I mean, yeah, but you're looking for ideas that spark off other ideas. So for each of these places, in a way, you're often looking for a great story about how this place existed, how it was found. I mean, some of the places in here, you touched on the idea of Madeira, date back to the point when global exploration was a lot more of a haphazard activity. And, you know, a huge degree of chance was involved in finding your way to somewhere or even finding your way back from somewhere.
And that's how a lot of these places, because a lot of this celebrates the kind of the haphazardness of exploration and the accidental things. And even in your introduction, you mentioned Mercator, who most people will know associated with maps. But it sounds from the name like a Portuguese explorer who supposedly made up quite a lot of his trips, which is fantastic.
A lot of early maps were, you know, cribbages from already existing maps. And there was occasionally nothing to stop someone inking in a bit of ground that they claimed to have been to because no one else had been there. Actually, I mean, this, it's not in the introduction, but I found some new stuff about Mercator only fairly recently, that his maps were recently a bit of a flop because although they were an improvement on maps that had existed before, they sacrificed some of the flouncier elements of earlier maps. And actually, it was only when they were republished and given a kind of, you know, Phil Spector flourish by a later map mate that they suddenly took off. I mean, there was a complaint that a set of Mercator's maps only had one monster and two ships on the kind of, you know, in the Hibby Dragons bit.
Not nearly Rococo enough.
No, exactly. No. So his maps, I mean, the point really, I suppose, about Mercator and his projection is he finds a way of representing the 3D world on 2D paper. Yeah. And he does it by kind of a distortion. And I mentioned it in the introduction in a way because lots of contemporary maps, even though we have satellite geotechnology and pinpoint mapping, still rely on this method. And so in a way, in order to convey a reality to us that works, even though it's, of course, a distortion. So in a way, the idea that the map and the territory are entirely the same is an illusion. There's always going to be some slippage in that. And so I think of that as the romance of maps and place.
And there's a bit of that. There's a bit of Google Maps obviously being the ubiquitous online choice for most people. Mm. Obviously, lots of other people doing it. But there's a thing that we think that that is, that has to be exactly how things appear on the ground. And of course, any map is, I suppose, just a 2D approximation of what things are like in real life. And that's where your book kind of comes in, it seems to me, by kind of giving it, fleshing out the strangeness, the serendipity, the haphazard, the accidental in all of these places. So where do you kind of get the idea from, at least in the examples that you've put in your book? Are you looking for the bits? I mean, I track out stories on Google Maps because it's such a good way of kind of going, well, I haven't been there, I wonder what lies between these two places. Was that kind of a bit of the way you did
this? Yeah, I mean, the thing about this, you know, we talk about reading a map. Robert Louis Stevenson, you know, based Treasure Island, having drawn a map, you know, and a story kind of grew from that. Mm. In some respects, this is slightly the reverse in a way that I've traced the stories and then Martin Brown, who did the maps, then had to go and find the places and kind of ink them in. There are sort of ranges. Some of them are, I mean, they're sort of, the book's broken down into four sections and they're all loosely themed. So there's one that's just called Accidental Discoveries, which includes, you know, things like the Dead Sea Scrolls being discovered by a stray goat breaking down to the surface and a shepherd boy finding this pot with these rolls of these scrolls inside them. And similarly, you know, a similar occasion really with Lascaux, the caves in France, which have those great prehistoric paintings on them. It was a sort of broken tree and a teenage boy who kind of stumbles upon them.
Just animals. Sorry, Travis. Just animals.
If only, maybe, you know, a follow-up volume. Accidental animal discoveries.
The cloven hooves that have led to our greatest quasi-religious discoveries.
And some of them have, you know, the story of it is more about the oddness of how they're founded, you know, something like, you know, the Buzzard, I can't pronounce it, it's impossible to pronounce this, but the Bulgarian communist monument, you know, which is this sort of astonishing spaceship of the thing, is at this particular connected to point in kind of Bulgarian history and communism and so on. So it has a backstory. And then there are things like the Georgia colony in Savannah, where it was designed along the idea that this was the new world and therefore a city should be structured in an egalitarian way. So it's a grid system. And then there are some which are geographical or geological, you know, curios, you know, so like the Rainbow Mountains in China that are a particular sort of geological form, or Knaresborough's petrifying well, where, you know, where it has a particular calcinate quality of the water means that any object that put it in is turned to stone.
There's such a great sort of anecdotal quality to all these places as well. This is, it's a kind of book you want to get as a gift and then regurgitate, pretending that you've thought it up or that you somehow know it. I've been testing out some of the people upstairs, Tom. I don't think they think it was stuff I knew before.
Not great. Put it that way, yeah. Well, I was interested in that in terms of, because there's a fair bit of, not myth busting, but there's certain mythologies that you track. And I wonder, when you go around the globe, their stories are so different. They come from such different eras and epochs of time. Are there some familiar strands, though, Travis, that run through? Certainly maybe in terms of how people mythologize or the kinds of conceits and imaginings they have. Yeah, are there some trains that run through everything?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there are certainly familiar I suppose there are also things in a way where in some parts of the history, something like Nowa-Huta in Poland, which was this Stalinist created city outside Krakow, the story of that is maybe not the cheeriest. And so for some people, that's something they want to forget, and hence, you know, you have things of people removing old, you know, Stalinist monuments and removing the names from places. Yeah. So sometimes, you know, history of place can be too tainted for the people who live near it, and they want to kind of bury that story and that history, and it might have an area of sort of shame. So, that, I mean, that's one element where, of course, from the outsiders, that it has a different perspective and different form of fascination. Yeah. But certainly, I mean, the idea of just people, you know, travelling to the far corners of the globe and, you know, and thinking they've found one thing and they haven't, they've found something else. It's something of a recurring trip. I mean, America wouldn't have been found if Columbus hadn't miscalculated the distance of the ocean, you know. And so it was like, you know, so, and he went to his grave thinking he'd still in Asia. He never knew he'd discovered the Americas as such. Yeah. So, you know, so all of those kind of little details certainly feed
him. You mentioned Martin Brown, the illustrator of the maps. From his point of view, it's quite a straight project of laying down the grid or the crazy paving or whatever it is and the topography of the places you found. That feels like quite a purposeful thing, I should say. I was going to say accidental. I see, it feels like another accidental thing about this, but it feels like a purposeful thing because you need a kind of form to accommodate the mess, I suppose, in this sense. You're going on quite a broad historical, anecdotal route.
Definitely.
The way you've written this. And Martin's obviously got a different job in the duo. Here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the maps, I mean, it is an atlas. It does have kind of maps in it. But it's a sort of, I guess it's a storytelling atlas, isn't it, in a way, that you have, that's a terrible thing to say, doesn't it? You have the pictures, you know, and then you have the text.
Yeah.
So you can, you know, those of a mappish disposition can lose themselves in the, you know, in the contours.
I feel like you're explaining this to Baldrick somehow.
Yeah, I mean, well, in some sense, you know, they're both.
But there's something kind of, there's something very usable about the way that the book is kind of set out and the rest of it. How about the rhythm? Obviously, there's a great geographical and historical spread throughout the piece. But were you kind of trying to find a bit of everything to fit into each thing? Or did you find in the old world, for example, more kind of haphazard discoveries or more kind of irregular shaped layouts of towns and places and all the rest of it? How did you try to, or did you try to kind of be fairly egalitarian with the way it was arranged?
I mean, I think the difference between this and, I mean, the atlas I did beforehand, which was the Atlas of Improbable Places. So I described the Atlas of the Unexpected as a somewhat predictable follow-up to the Improbable Places book. I mean, that was much more about just sheer oddness, you know, kind of absolute oddness. So with this, we wanted that idea of serendipity and discovery and freak, and that could encompass both the form of the place, which perhaps was more what the Improbable Places book was, but also this idea of discovery and exploration. So I suppose, in a way, we allowed things that are perhaps already relatively well known in here in order to tell the story, which people often know less well. People maybe know Madeira, but they don't know the kind of historical romance element of its supposed discovery. Similarly, things like the Dead Sea Scrolls. People know about the Dead Sea Scrolls, but maybe they don't know that it was found because of a goat. And you know,
I like the Freshkills Park. Everyone knows, kind of everyone feels that they know the parks of New York City and the five boroughs. But tell us a little bit about this one.
Well, Freshkills is on Staten Island.
Yeah.
And it was a massive rubbish dump. Robert Moses, the great, or depending on your middle, great, it's not quite the right word. Somewhat,
New York's houseman.
Yeah, exactly, yes. The reshaper of New York, shall we say, in the latter part of the 20th century. A man certainly with a very bold idea about what he thought the city was like, but obviously people like Jane Jacobs fought, you know, a great campaign to prevent him destroying lots of amazing bits of New York. But he, essentially, Freshkills in Staten Island became New York's dumping ground, and it was, you know, it was still in operation, and actually some of the last waste that was buried on Freshkills came from 9/11, so it was still operational at that point. But there's an interesting historical element, which is that Frederick Law Olmsted, who was the co-designer of Central Park in New York, began as an experimental farmer and lived and raised a farm on Staten Island, and then obviously went off and created Central Park, which is New York's first purpose-built public park. So there's a nice circularity in a way that actually what's happened now is that Freshkills has been reclaimed from landfill and is now this wonderful public park, and all of that trash is buried and decontaminated, and you know, and it's sort of this area of Staten Island has come back to life on Staten Island in some way that Frederick Law Olmsted, the great landscape architect of America, once lived. So there seems something rather nice about
it. It's something nice and sort of circular about
exactly,
that.
Yeah.
Freshkills, what a name.
They got the name. I wonder, Travis, you were talking a little bit about selecting these places and the fact that some places were not, they may be unexpected, but perhaps not wholly unknown.
Yeah.
Were there places where they either were too unexpected or not unexpected enough to make the cut? I'm always as interested in the things that didn't perhaps make the final version as those that did.
It's a very good question. There was one place where, now I can't remember what it was. Classically, I can't remember what it was now.
That's the Atlas of Unpublishable.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. There was one place where, on paper, it looked like it was going to be fascinating. I can't remember what it was now, unfortunately, sorry. But then the story was just like, you know, dillum. Yeah. Kind of, you know, it was very... Yeah. And I mean, there's a kind of element you don't, you know, rather like the sort of Roald Dahl, Tales of the Unexpected, there's an element where if it's just so dull, then they found it, you know, or then, you know, someone lifted the cheese off the map and they've discovered there,
oh, there
was,
it
you know,
is.
Yeah. So it has to have a little bit more scope for in the I mean, there are things in here like the sort of Gruner Sea, which is an underwater park in Austria, where in a sense the story is that it's just, it's on the side of a mountain. So in winter months, you know, it's a mountainside because it's frozen and, you know, there's a park and there are benches. And then in the summer when the ice melts, it becomes underwater. So that's basically the story with that one. You know? But, you know, but it's, you know, so, I mean, some of them are, you know, simpler tales than others, shall we say.
I so think there's a kind of possibly a cruise, you know, the celebrity cruises that you get, and it's a kind of, or there's expertise delivered on this. I think we should we charter a monocle kind of cruise ship? Who's going to captain it? I don't know, but I know who the guest speaker's going to be. I kind of want to go. I kind of want to go to half these places. They're really kind of wonderful, kind of beguiling stuff. Travis, congratulations!
Thank you.
On another wonderful atlas of this one is Atlas of the Unexpected, Haphazard Discoveries, Chance Places, and Unimaginable Destinations, and it is out now. Travis, thanks as ever.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Rob, music. Time for a tune.
Yes,
you game?
Please. Yes.
Well, here's an unexpected discovery that we made ourselves this week. It's Paris-based duo Dominique Dumont seeing out summer with Le Soleil dans le monde, the sun in the world.
That was Dominique Dumont from Paris there with Le Soleil dans le Monde, and you are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly.
The Miseducation of Cameron Post is a new film telling the story of a teenager pressured into conversion therapy by her parents in the 1990s in the misled belief that same-sex relationships are a thing to be, in quotes, cured.
Adapted from the recent novel of the same name from Emily M. Danforth, the film's young stars, Chloe Grace Moretz, Sasha Lane and Forrest Goodluck, have been praised for their performances, steered by the Iranian-American director Desiree Akhavan.
Earlier, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco sat down with Desiree to discuss the film. First, though, let's have a listen.
Welcome to God's promise.
And you are at an age where you are especially vulnerable to evil.
Change will come through God, but within me.
We're going to spend our time together investigating what led you here.
In the past, I would resort to self-pleasure. But then when I learned that that was a sin also, I stopped.
Cameron, your struggle is with the sin of same-sex attraction. You're facing the consequences of your actions, and it's ugly.
Why does she give such a shit?
I guess it's like having your own Disney villain. Only this one won't let you jerk off.
You don't really seem like the kind of person that'd be here.
We didn't have a choice, did you?
You better be ready for the dark.
Desiree Akhavan, welcome to Monocle 24. First of all, I have to say your film is very touching and superb. I really, really enjoyed.
Thank you so much.
I just want to know, how did you get involved with the project? Of course, the film is based on a novel from 2012. Mm. I mean, did you read the novel, and were you always kind of interested in doing an adaptation?
I read the book when it first came out, and I loved it. And it spoke to me in a way that no book has about teen coming of age, teen sexuality, teen friendship. I read it and I gave it to my girlfriend at the time, and she loved it. And neither of us had read anything quite like this before. So she told me to make it into a movie. She was the one who had the idea. I didn't feel equipped to do it at all. So that was in 2012. I put it on the back burner. I thought, one day I want to make that into a movie. And when I was traveling the festival circuit with my first film, Appropriate Behavior, I shared the book with my producing partner, and I said, one day we should make this. And she read it, and she loved it as much as I loved it, and said, we're doing it now. So she got the rights, and then we started writing.
And it's interesting because, you know, it does deal with very kind of a sad topic, which is gay conversion therapy. But it's not that the film treats it lightly. But there's humor in it. And there's not, even the people in the camp, they're not exactly villains, you know. You kind of almost humanize them as well. Was that your intention?
Yeah,
as well?
For sure. I f- felt if I had done my job well, you would at points relate the most to the heads of this gay conversion therapy center. I mean, to us, when we were going into it, gay conversion therapy was a metaphor. We didn't think it was a relevant problem. We didn't set about making a relevant film. And unfortunately, over the course of making it, it hit us that it was a relevant movie. And it was a sad realization. But we wanted to make a teen comedy, you know, in the vein of John Hughes. We wanted to tell a story about a young woman's sexuality and desire and her coming into her own. And also that moment in life when you realize that the adults don't really know what they're doing and it's all the blind leading the blind. I feel like teen films in the past two decades have really talked down to the experience of coming of age and really neutered their characters. And one thing I realized while making this film is that I'm basically the same person I was when I was 15. Essentially, my taste, my humor, my sense of the world is the same. I just didn't have any experience or agency back then. So it seems absurd to me that we make teens to be these lame infants that yeah. They don't quite know what they're doing, and they're so stupid in movies and inarticulate. I feel like teens actually, and also even their experiences of trauma, we really talk down to it. And the most trauma I knew in my life, I knew as a teenager, the stakes felt so high. And even if it was just in my head, even if it was just angst, and that's why gay conversion therapy felt like such a ripe setting for this. The stakes were just as high as they could be, and yet the humor and the absurdity of the situation rang so true.
Do you know someone that has been through gay conversion therapy, or you've just been reading? Because it's something that actually is still fairly common these days, which is awful.
Yes, it still exists. It exists in the UK. It exists with a vengeance, weirdly, in America. I didn't realize that when I first set out starting this. I didn't know anybody when I started, but I met with people throughout the course of the year that we were researching gay conversion therapy.
And we have to mention, I mean, the film has an amazing 90s references. And, well, maybe I can say this, I'm a bit of a kid of the 90s. It's just fantastic when, you know, when the main character, when she's singing, you know, What's Up? And, you know, tell us, would you make sure, are you also kind of a kid from the
90s? Yeah, I'm a kid of the 90s for sure.
Yeah, so
I mean, Four Non Blondes were my favorite band. Well, The Breeders was my favorite. And I really wanted to have references to these pop culture points that were super queer and really good, and I wanted Cameron to have good taste. I don't think the film is heavy with its 90s period references, but we had a Sears catalog as our reference point aesthetically for the clothing, and we tried to keep it honest and true to that time.
Where is the film set? Because it looks quite nice.
We wanted to keep it ambiguous Americana. The book is set in Montana. That's a real big plot point of the book. We couldn't afford to shoot in Montana. New York State has really good tax rebates. We had to shoot in New York State, so we shot up in Woodstock, Saugerties, New York, which is up by Woodstock. And we all lived in the location that we shot on. So we got very close. The whole cast and crew lived there together. And we shot, you know, 6 days of the week. And we're just kind of stuck there for about a month. Trump got elected right in the middle of the shoot.
Oh, really?
It was a really surreal experience. But in the making of the film, I wanted it to feel just very ambiguous as to where they were, but that they felt isolated and lost in that space.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the casting. I mean, Cameron Post, performance by Chloe Grace Moretz. I mean, and you're right. I think she managed. You wanted to do a little bit more treating, you know, teenagers as intelligent people and not just as stupid as you rightly so mentioned. And I think she did a fantastic job of that.
I guess the thing is infantilize and naive. I think that teens are seen in media and on television as super naive victims. And I didn't want that. I wanted there to be agency. I wanted there to be desire. I think Chloe puts herself on the line here that it's not an easy performance. She lives a lot in the close-up and has very little dialogue. Cameron's kind of an introverted character, and it's the ensemble around her that pops. Chloe could handle that ensemble. I think a lot of other actors would need to show off, and especially Chloe was a teenager when we were shooting. She really handled herself amongst those other characters. It's hard to keep a character from being opaque when she speaks so little and takes in so much. But Cameron was an ode for me to any woman I've loved. I mean, I know Chloe from big Hollywood movies like Kick-Ass and Neighbors 2. And if I stay, you know, real princessy star vehicles. And Cameron's a dyke with swagger, you know. Mm. Cameron fucks a bunch of girls in this movie and is a top, you know. It's not just, she's not passive in any of it. And I was really excited to watch this girl that I had seen grow up in, like, a Scorsese film, you know, being this adorable little ingenue. I wanted to see her have some agency and desire and see that kind of queer point of view through her eyes. And I'm really impressed with what she brought to the table.
I wonder, how do you feel about the industry? Because even films like, you know, teen films, even rom-coms, I mean, they are becoming slowly but surely a little bit more diverse. You know, we had films as well like Love, Simon and among others. Do you think the industry is changing or there's still a lot to go?
Those films, Call Me By Your Name and Love, Simon, that got wide releases in the States and were heavily advertised are all stories of male sexuality and male coming of age. I think it's really cool that they're out there and I'm excited, but I also keep looking around for their female counterparts and can't find them. I mean, this film, not to play my tiny violin, but we won the Sundance Grand Jury Prize and then took 2 months to sell in America. We had a very easy time in the UK and in France, but when it came to the American sale, it took months and months. And there was a lot of fear around putting out a film about female desire. And that showed a queer female character in this light. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think it's very much about fear of women in roles of sexual agency.
And being a top, as you mentioned as well.
Maybe
that's the fear as well.
But
on the other hand, there's been some talk, you know, that the film, you know, the award season, well, it's kind of getting closer. Still feel, you know, but there's been some talk. Do you have any expectations?
No,
I mean, or
I'll
you're just
when I see it.
You're just relaxed now.
I do not listen to talk. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
It's always every year people need things to write about. So they'll write about anything. I would be so grateful and happy if this film had the power to touch the mainstream. And that's what it means with awards. It's not the best films don't win awards. The films that are sold to you the most win awards. And I would love for this film to be unavoidable. Realistically, do I think that the public crave this? I think they crave it. Do I think the powers that be will follow suit? I don't know. I'm hopeful. I think it's a great film with a mainstream appeal and great comedy and great sex, and I'm so excited. I think if you watch it, you'll like it. I mean, my conservative Iranian family loves it, and not just because I made it. I think it's the kind of film that you can go in with any background and connect to something in it, which is what I'm so proud of. And that's not just my work. This was a film made by women, queer women, my cinematographer, my editor, my co-writer and producer, everybody, female, queer. That's their work. That's their authenticity, and that's their storytelling ability. So I would love, love, love for this to reach a wide audience because I think they'll embrace it if they got it. But whether that will be a reality in America, I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's a fantastic project,
thanks,
Desiree, I have to say. And if you don't mind speaking, you're also quite busy. You also have a new project at Channel
yeah.
4, right?
Yeah.
The Bisexual. Could you tell us a few words?
Of course, I mean, I would love to.
When is it going to be released or what is it about?
The same week that Cameron Post was greenlit, I also got greenlit for this television series for Channel 4. I moved from my hometown of New York to London to make The Miseducation of Cameron Post. I co-wrote it with my producing partner, and she lives in London. So I just moved into her couch for months until I found a place of my own and set up camp here and then pitched this television series. I'd always wanted to make a bisexual dating comedy. And I had pitched it in America, and it was rejected everywhere. And then I found myself living in London, so I was like, what the hell? I'll pitch out this script. And I did, and then I had my choice here of who I wanted to make it with. As I was making Cameron Post, we were also co-writing this TV series. It's a dating comedy. It's about a woman in her 30s who's been lesbian, self-identified her whole life, and she secretly starts dating men and is outed as bisexual. And it's sort of about her sexual coming of age in her 30s, the discrepancy between the sex we have versus the sex we want, and also about this reverse taboo of what happens to her life and her family of friends when that happens. I play that girl, that woman, I'm in my 30s. I can think I can say woman. And she works with her ex-partner, who's played by Maxine Peake. I think it ends up being a love story between the two of them and a buddy comedy between the bisexual woman and her flatmate, who is a straight white man, played by Brian Gleason. It's just flat-out comedy, and I'm really excited about it. It comes out on Channel 4 in October.
Well, I look forward to see it. And
thank you.
Desiree, thank you very much for
coming
here.
Thanks for having me.
Desiree Akhavan there, speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The Miseducation of Cameron Post is out now. This is the Monocle Weekly.
Rossif Sutherland is an actor who knows his history. Not only is he starring in new Canadian horror flick Trench 11, set amid the very real horrors of the First World War, but he's also a name that will be familiar to some, being the son of acting great Donald Sutherland and half-brother of the equally ubiquitous Kiefer.
Monocle's Thomas Lewis recently met the Canadian actor to discuss Trench 11 and some of the inspirations and challenges to be found in joining the family business. Here's a clip of the new film.
Gentlemen,
we are here to complete a vitally important mission. In May of last year, the Germans began constructing an underground bunker 11 miles behind their lines.
What the devil are they doing there?
We don't know, but they've dug 3 to 4 levels. They've gone as deep as 100 feet, sir.
My God.
Whatever they were working on is still there.
This base is abandoned, so we don't expect any resistance.
Well, how do we know it's abandoned?
This base has been sealed for a reason.
It takes place at the end of the First World War. I play a tunneler. My character's job was to dig deep under the front lines. Well, pretty much where two armies would meet, there'd be a standstill and people would be in the trenches. And I would dig, along with my team, dig deep underground, sometimes 70 feet, create this maze so I could hopefully set explosives and kind of disrupt the stalemate and create an advantage for the Allies in my case. But this is at the end of the war, and there's been this German scientist that has been working on this disease that he inflicts on people, which turns them into fighting machines. There's also a life sentence. I mean, you die within 3 days or so, and you're highly contagious. His idea and his hope with the war coming to an end and them losing the war was to spread this across Europe and kind of reset the table so that they could get the advantage in the world that they set off to have when the war began. Well, this was a subject matter that Matt Bui and Leo Sherman, the writers, Leo Sherman was the director of the film, were fascinated with. It's so hard for films to get seen that they had to reimagine history so it would fit in a genre. But I mean, there was poisonous gas. People were researching those things because it was the best way to get an advantage on such a large scale. Sure, there is some basis in reality, but they obviously took a lot of liberties. But that aspect of the underground war was something they wanted to put on film.
And your performance as part of that story, you talk about the film trying to capture a sense of claustrophobia and this kind of underbelly of the war, literally and sort of figuratively. How do you go about trying to portray someone who is under such intense pressure, both in terms of the confines physically he finds himself in, but also in terms of someone who has come through years and years of war, not wanting to be a part of that war?
Yeah, he was there very reluctantly. As far as research, you know, you crowd yourself with images of that time. There was a documentary series, you know, you feed yourself with that, but ultimately I find as an actor, and this is something I've discovered as the years have gone by and I've done this more and more, is that sometimes too much research makes you intellectualize things too much. All in all, your job as an actor is, in order to be believable, you have to... It's a very strange thing between action and cut, that we care so much as actors, that you're transported into another reality. I know people think of actors as liars, because it's true, these are not our words, and we are trying to be believable, and that's the description of a liar, but but in many ways, it's quite the opposite. It's about finding a truth. And so that's the challenge. I mean, as far as claustrophobia and reluctance to being somewhere, we all experience that in our life. And, you know, it's the power of imagination. Seeing those walls being wheeled about and trying to stay in the moment, it's a challenge. But you always have the support of the people that you're working with, your fellow actors. And if people are doing their job and they believe same as you, all you have to do is look around and they take you where you need to be. So,
and give us a sense of what, I suppose, the sort of general impression of films that try to capture war very broadly, that a lot of those stories are based in camaraderie or the relationships, yes, unlikely relationships in many senses, between the characters, between the soldiers being portrayed. How did you sort of capture that with your fellow members of the cast in this film?
Well, it's the power of the shared experience, you know, and when the stakes are high, it's like you're on a speed track to friendship. You can also be on a speed track to just really hating somebody's guts, but it's a very common thing in films. Projects put together, you end up shooting for a couple months, and it's a very intense environment, and you become very fast friends, and some people call themselves family. It's because we go through something extraordinarily intense, and also we're just playing, all the while taking ourselves seriously, playing, being kids and adults at the same time. It's a very unusual exercise that we partake in.
Does it feel as though if you are making something on a relative shoestring, is that a sort of frustration? Is there something you feel as though you're sort of being slightly held back in the sort of making of the story you're trying to tell? Or is there something quite freeing, strangely, about having to be conscious about those things, but actually maybe relying quite heavily on each other or on the script or whatever it is?
I don't do a lot of big budget films. The first film I ever did was a big budget film, and there was the luxury of, you know, overtime and reshoots and stuff like that. There was no room for this. We knew that we couldn't go over, and we knew we only had so many days, and I think the budget still went over. I don't want to compare the film to poetry, but I'm going to compare the process to poetry, where you know that you only have so many syllables and you know it needs to rhyme at the end. Sometimes within those confines, there's a certain freedom because you know you only have so much to make it work, but it's the exercise, it is to make it work. And sometimes it brings all that more creativity because you don't really have the choice to look around and say, this would be great, that would be great, this would be great, we should get this, we should get that crane, we should do this. It's just, we have what we have, and let's make it work. I find great joy in that. I find great joy in working with very young people, very ambitious young people who have a vision and want to see it come through, and oftentimes it's their first or second film. Certainly as an actor, finding myself on little films like that, I end up having to wear multiple hats, you know, because oftentimes I've done quite a few more than they have, so I know that we have to finish our day. Oftentimes actors will ask for another take, you know, we'll always want another take, we'll always want to try something else, but you find yourself in that environment where you know you need to finish your day, and it's a fast-moving bullet, and you just gotta make sure you have the pieces at the end of the day. So sometimes, well, you have to make things work, but they're not gonna be a complete reflection of what you had imagined, which is something that's quite challenging for some people to detach themselves from, because they've worked on it, they've imagined it so much that, and it's quite a precise picture in their head, that when they have to just accept something else, it can be quite a challenge, because the day just gets shorter and shorter and shorter, and you just keep putting scenes off to a day that just doesn't exist. That's a hard reality. It's just the pragmatic, the practical aspect of it. My tendency is that people realize that quite quickly, and it actually turns into something quite exciting, because instead of the film that they had imagined, it becomes something else. It becomes, I don't know the film that was in Leo's head, but I could see him at times be excited by the surprise of what happens in the moment, and it's about embracing it. It takes quite a bit of courage, I guess, as an artist to be able to settle be able to say, you know, this is good enough, we gotta move on now. But as far as the romantic notion of it, I mean, sure, there's the romance of the first day of we're actually doing this, man. This is great. It's not a very glamorous thing to do, films. Some people think, you know, I mean, from gossip magazines and the very glamorous lives that people lead, that, you know, these films kind of just fall from the sky. But they're a lot of hard work. But I love my job, and I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. I started off as an actor quite reluctantly, having to play a part in a film that I was directing for a friend of mine at Princeton University. She was a senior thesis, and my lead actor didn't show up on the first day of shooting, and that's why I had to step in front of the camera. My father, who's an actor, thought the world of it, which I thought was extraordinarily flattering. But it was quite the journey for me to actually come to the place where I fell in love with the job. And it was thanks to a teacher who's now passed away, Harold Guskin. He put it very simply to me. When I thought acting was about pretending to be other people, he said, it's not about pretending to be other people. Acting is the permission to be all the people that you could have been. And when you put it that way, and those words always live in my head, that I'm not spending my time lying, pretending. I'm actually very selfishly giving myself permission to live a life that could have been mine. And if this is the one and only life that I get, I'll be able to say that even just for a moment, and sometimes it really is just a moment in a performance that lasts a couple of months, you know, good or bad, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because I get a taste of a truth, you know, a taste of an experience that I wouldn't have had otherwise.
To sort of go back to your father, your family, yeah. As you alluded to, you are one member of a very prominent acting family. You say that your entry into acting was a reluctant kind of move and a necessity, I guess, for the situation at the time. Is that quite a rich kind of context in which to be your own actor when you do have siblings, a father who are so well known for playing very different characters and very sort of different types of films and TV programs? What kind of environment is that? Is that a network of support, or is it sort of healthy competition, or is it a source of advice? What kind of conversations do you have, say, with your father, for example?
My father was my champion, my sponsor. He's the one who, he didn't bully me into this, but he really encouraged me. And there were a few times when I was ready to give up. I hadn't started acting. I was just doing classes, and I didn't get it. I thought actors were really interesting people, but I just didn't relate. And that notion of that I wanted to spend my life just trying to answer some questions and figure out who I was, and, you know, all those grand questions that we have in our late teens. I can look at those questions now, and I know that there isn't an answer, but it doesn't haunt me the way that it did before. My father's been very encouraging, which certainly been helpful, because it is a very solitary life, you know, as far as trying to find work. You are dependent on the opportunity that somebody else gives you. I'm not walking back and forth in my apartment reciting Shakespeare, although maybe I should, you know. But as far as it being competitive or not, I was so reluctant to be an actor that my journey to fall in love with the craft made it really my own, you know. I wasn't doing it for anybody else but myself. I had no ambition to change the world. I had no ambition really to inspire anybody but myself. I haven't had all that easy a journey. It's been quite a struggle to find work. I've had some years that were great, some years that weren't. But still, I keep plugging because I love the job. You know, sure, I envy my father's career, all the people that he's worked with, and he worked in a different time in cinema that, you know, it's long gone now, and even just the process of being cast is so different than when my father was starting out. You know, I had to explain to my father what a casting director was, because in his time you would meet with the writer and the director, and there weren't all these barriers to cross, and acting also wasn't as popular a craft. Now you find yourself going to casting calls, and it's quite a cattle call. You know, Not that I'm comparing actors to cows, but in the sense that it is really just, it's such a crowd, and you have to somehow shine within a mass of people, and you find yourself in those rooms full of dreamers, same as I. And when I was starting out, it was quite difficult for me because I'd find myself sitting there running my lines as somebody else is running theirs, and thinking, I wish you had the part, man, because you look great, and it's competitive, but also I don't know, I'm a strange bird, but most actors are. They're quite fascinating people, and it's always a privilege to be surrounded by them.
Rossif Sutherland there, speaking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis in Toronto. And Trench 11 is out in the coming weeks. You are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. And that, Tom, is it for edition 479 of the Monocle Weekly. Another one bites the dust in a really nice way. Great guests on today. A very cinematic show we had today.
Can I just say that it was an expected delight talking about Unexpected Treasures with Travis Elborough, a friend of the programme.
And Desiree Akhavan, that film, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, has been super well reviewed. We did an iteration of The Culture Show a couple of weeks back where its praises were sung, so it's kind of nice to hear her take on that being turned into a movie as well.
We had all sorts of talent.
Great stuff. Let's thank our friends behind the glass, Tom. Today's show was, of course, produced by Tom Paul, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.